Impeachment 2. This time it's bipartisan. Governor Holcomb's proposed state budget, plus Lilly turns off the contribution tax for some, and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending January 15th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana's 7 Republican and 2 Democratic U.S. House representatives did not break with their parties in a historic House vote that saw President Donald Trump impeached for the second time. The House voted 232 to 197 to impeach Trump a week after the president's supporters stormed the Capitol in a chaotic scene that left several people dead. 10 Republicans broke party ranks to vote in favor of impeachment, but Indiana's Congress members were not among them. Republican Jackie Walorski's post-vote statement said impeachment would neither unify nor strengthen the country ahead of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration. And one of Indiana's newest members of Congress, Republican Victoria Spartz, took to Twitter, writing, "As someone who didn't support objections to certification last week, I will not support this political charade of impeachment today." The Hoosier State's other newest federal lawmaker, Frank Mervan, joined his Democratic colleagues to impeach.
"I support the article of impeachment so that we can move forward to do the work that our constituents sent us here to do."
Democrat Andre Carson joined Mervan in voting in favor of impeachment, calling it a sad but necessary duty. What's the point of a second impeachment that's unlikely, it seems, to end in a Senate conviction? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, what's the point of this?
Oh, come on, Brandon. Is that a serious question?
It's a very serious question. What is the point?
You have the president of the United States inciting a riot, spending 4 years lying, and the biggest lie he's ever told is that he won the election and was stolen from him. They all knew, those 7 Republicans from Indiana who voted not to impeach him knew that, as did Mike Braun, Mike Pence, and Todd Rokita. They all knew that, and they perpetuated a lie. They stirred up the crazy white supremacist groups that support Donald Trump, and he had lit the match and sent him to the statehouse. He knew that he couldn't win, and he was prepared to overthrow the government in order to keep power. And we're going to let that go unchecked? It's ridiculous to let that pass. It reminds me of when Susan Collins said after the first impeachment, well, she didn't vote for it because he's learned his lesson. He wouldn't do it again. Oh, no, he'd do much worse. You cannot let somebody who commits a crime in front of the TV cameras by inciting people to riot and storm the Capitol go without punishment. If the Senate chooses not to do its job because they're as afraid of the Trump base as Mike Braun, Mike Pence, Todd Rokita, and those 7 minions are, then the history books will be very unkind to them because they put their own party and their political survival ahead of the country. And that's inexcusable conduct.
Mike O'Brien, does the fact that the Senate seems unlikely to convict President Trump figure into the political calculation of impeaching him in the House?
About to have a new Senate, so the math's about to change. I do agree that the first impeachment was a political spectacle. I don't agree that this one was. I don't know what the founders conceived of when they came up with a mechanism to remove a president from office, but surely the threshold is at least inciting a mob that invaded the Capitol and attempted to stop the counting of electoral votes. We just know today or late in this week exactly how close more violent members of that mob actually got to members of Congress, how close they were. 1 minute, Mike Pence was 1 minute from being removed from the floor of the Senate before it was taken over. It's horrific, and we're learning more and more details. Some of the video that came out this week, so the cell phone videos are being collected by the FBI, and we're starting to see this wasn't just a bunch of hillbillies taking selfies in the on the speaker's rostrum. These were people some people, I don't think all of them did, certainly not, but a small group of them certainly had a mission when they were going there. And so I think this act was appropriate.
John Schwanis,
I'd like to make, can I make one point on that, Brendan?
Sure.
I think whoever the staff person was that was with Mike Pence on the dais there, who had the presence of mind to remove the ballots, deserves a great deal of credit. Because if those ballots had been there and been burned, Donald Trump would have been calling for a new election. And whoever that person was, I don't know, nobody's even mentioned his name or her name, but they deserve a lot of credit for having the smarts to keep those ballots safe.
John Schwanis, something we've been hearing around the impeachment vote this week is something that Jackie Walorski said essentially in her post-vote statement, which was the idea that this impeachment process is not helping unity or togetherness that we need now as a country. But Jackie Walorski refuses to recognize Joe Biden as the democratically elected president of the United States. At what point do Republicans in Congress have to work towards unity?
I agree. That's the charade here, is being committed by those members of Congress who suggest somehow in this bizarro world we're living in that they are supporters of unity, and those who are seeking adherence to the rule of law, which has served us well for well over two centuries as a country, is somehow the problem. You know, history will not be kind, as has been mentioned already, as Anne suggested, to lawmakers who I think opposed the rule of law in this instance. Fortunately for them, history is not voting registered to vote in their districts. So they probably will not suffer any real consequences now. History, maybe they don't care about history. Maybe they don't care about their legacies. That's unfortunate. But back to the rule of law, that's what we do. Practicality doesn't come into it. Hey, sometimes crimes are committed on camera, or we have 100 witnesses. We could say dispense with the trial. That's impractical. Why spend money? But guess what? We go through a trial. We have due process. We do things the right way in this country, thankfully, and I hope that doesn't stop anytime soon.
Nikki Kelly, this is a hard question to answer. You know, neither you nor I have any sort of special insight into the halls of Congress, but do you think there's any chance that the Senate votes to convict?
Look, if there's anything I've learned in the last 2-3 years is don't underestimate that anything could happen. So, you know, what do I think it's likely? Probably not. But regardless, you know, President Trump will go down with the dubious distinction of being the only president impeached twice. And so, I mean, that alone.
So far.
Yes, that's how history works. So,
are you saying he's going to go for number three?
All right. Well, time now
well, you know, if McConnell wants him out of the Republican Party, the only way to do that is to impeach him twice so he can't run again.
Yeah, a conviction in the Senate would mean he couldn't run again in 4 years or 8 years or any time in the future.
Forever.
Time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice-Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, will the second impeachment have any impact on President Donald Trump's political future? A, yes, it will be positive. B, yes, it will be negative. Or C, it won't really have an impact. Last week, we asked you if you're worried about negative health consequences from the entire NCAA men's basketball tournament coming to Indiana this spring. About half, a little over half, 55% say yes, you are a little worried about that. 45% say no. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Governor Eric Holcomb's new state budget proposal would spend more than $1 billion over the next 2 years on one-time initiatives, and almost none of that would be direct relief for Hoosiers struggling during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Holcomb administration officials call the state's financial situation a pleasant surprise. Indiana budget reserves should return to pre-pandemic levels this year. And because of that, Office of Management and Budget Director Chris Johnston says the governor wants to prioritize one-time expenses on items like paying down debt, broadband expansion, and cash funding a swine barn at the state fairgrounds.
Use these monies in a way to have a significant impact without creating ongoing obligations that we cannot fund over the long term.
Holcomb's proposed state budget does increase K-12 funding by $377 million over the next 2 years, but otherwise state spending would be flat from the current budget, and Democrats like Representative Greg Porter wonder why that's true for some items.
Why would we not increase dollars for food banks, for the human infrastructure of people who are in need of food?
Johnston says food banks, like other groups that have struggled during the pandemic, have received support from federal COVID relief. Mike O'Brien, using reserves to pay down debt has long been a strategy of Governor Holcomb and Indiana Republicans, and it's there are valid, legitimate, responsible reasons for it in terms of the savings that you might see in the future. But this year, is that the right call?
All I can say is I can't wait till the swine barn is done so we can stop talking about it on Indiana Week. There's nothing easier to demagogue than the swine barn, and we're about to see that from Ann, I'm sure. Well, there's a lot of wins in this budget. One, it's a $35.5 billion budget. The swine barn is $50 million of it, and paying down debt is $300 million of it. There's some big wins here in that they fully fund Medicaid, which is a program that is absolutely exploding in COVID. We have 1.6 million Hoosiers on Medicaid right now. That number's gone up obviously considerably in the last 10 or 11 months. So the fact that they were able to restore the reserves that had to be used and just in the Medicaid program is a big deal. The fact that K-12 education is getting an increase instead of a cut like it is in so many other states is a big deal. And, you know, look, and higher ed is getting their cuts restored and an increase over each year of the biennium. So, not to mention the fact that the surplus will be restored. And I know Democrats are going to take shots at that, but you've got to remember that we cash flowed state governments, loss of revenue, and we didn't require quarterly taxes to be remitted or tax payments for 2019 to be remitted until July of this year. We had to cash flow all that. And the reserve was why we were able to do it. So I know it's easy to take shots at some of these things, but this budget is unlike most that you're seeing in the country, where if you look at the cumulative effect of COVID, we have about $500 billion in debt and deficits sitting on state budgets right now. So Indiana's in a great spot.
And Delaney, let's look specifically at Holcomb's proposal for this fiscal year, at the end of the current state budget, before even getting into the new one. $700 million out of reserves, $302 million of which would be to pay down debt, and $400 million of which would be to pay down the pre-96 teacher retirement fund, which frees up state general fund money in the future to the tune of like $69 million a year. Is that worthwhile?
No, it's not. It would be worthwhile in a different year. It would be worthwhile if Governor Holcomb had fulfilled his promise to raise teacher salaries, which he's not done. That increase in the budget for K-12 is not going to do anything for teacher salaries. There are ways that this could be done where you could give incentives to the local governments, the local school boards and all to raise teacher salaries with state money. He's not doing any of that. And while I'm not opposed to paying down existing debt and paying it off, even the swine barn, this is not the time. Borrowing interest rates are at an all-time low. You know, it makes more sense to do that if we were paying 5, 6, 8% interest on these bonds, which we're not. And it just seems to me that he needs to meet the immediate needs that COVID has caused. Teacher salaries, regardless of COVID, but also the education shortfall that's come from having to have distance learning as opposed to, and in school learning in the same school districts. Broadband, that's a good idea because in this kind of environment, we need it. But some of these other things where he's taking money which could be used, the budget grew better. We don't need a surplus that's 13%. We don't, okay? The goal is not just to have a surplus. The goal is to have a surplus so that we're in needy times, like we are now, we can meet those needs. He's not doing that, and he's breaking his promise to teachers.
Nikki Kelly, what did Republican legislative leaders have to say about Holcomb's proposal for debts paying and things like that?
I didn't really get specific, and that'll obviously be discussed in the coming days. I do want to clarify one thing that's my cat. That $2.3 billion surplus, that's going to be there regardless. The $700 million we're talking about is this year. And an example of what we've done in the past is in 2012 when we had $721 million to do. You know what we did? Governor Daniels gave half of that to pension relief, and he put the rest of it in an automatic taxpayer refund, and it went back to the people, $111 each. Is that enough? Probably not. But, you know, I kind of compare this to regular people thoughts, which is if your car is broke down in your driveway and you can't get to work, but you win $1,000 in the lottery, do you fix the car or do you pay off your college loans early? You know, it's not bad to pay off college loans, but you can't get to work.
John Schwanes, John Schwanes, I think it was Todd Houston, Speaker Todd Houston, who asked about the governor's proposal, said, with surplus, with reserve dollars, there needs to be a balance. And House Republicans are already proposing, I think they're going to be proposing in the next week, $180 million for small business relief and summer learning programs to help some of the learning loss that seemingly every student has seen because of the pandemic. Is that what we are most likely to see at the end of this budget process?
I think so. I mean, there are demands that have to be addressed now. In a perfect world, and I think if you looked at it from a very clinical sense, we can all say that we are smart to look to 10 years into the future, or 20, our children, our grandchildren. That's smart, sound policy in terms of, you know, we maybe delay the instant gratification for the future. But guess what? That's not the environment that is the Indiana General Assembly or Congress or anything else that's responsive to the needs and wishes and whims of the day, of the moment. So while it may make sense that there's an opportunity here, as you said, Brandon, to generate $60+ million a year well into the future, that doesn't really satisfy those who say, well, that's great. And I guess Nikki did it better, said it better than I can with the example of the driveway moment there, or the car that won't start. But it's the same, I'll say it the same way in a less articulate way, which is people have needs now and they want them met now. And it doesn't really tell them, do them much good to say that, don't worry, in 10 years, you're going to have accrued a $600 million windfall from this.
All right. Well, the Political Action Committee of Indianapolis-based Eli Lilly has joined other major corporations in pausing political donations to some politicians after last week's insurrection at the Capitol. Lilly's move follows unfounded claims of election fraud made by some members of Congress, President Donald Trump, and members of his administration, and a vote to deny Joe Biden's Electoral College victory. The pharmaceutical giant's political arm said in a statement it will suspend giving to those who voted against certification of the election results. Quote, "We expect any candidate we support to demonstrate respect for people and respect for our democratic process and institutions." Four U.S. representatives from Indiana are among those affected, Republicans Jackie Walorski, Jim Banks, Jim Baird, and Greg Pence. Lilly has not said if or when the company will resume donations. John Schwanes, we talked last week about a lack of political fallout for the Republicans who voted against certifying the election results, but is this significant political fallout?
This is significant political fallout because it's no secret that money, in this day and age, is the lifeblood of American electoral politics. And so, yes, it speaks very, very loudly. And I think what speaks particularly loudly and has a bigger impact in all this is the actions taken by companies that decided not just to cease suspend all contributions, because that's like some voter, you know, saying, I'm just not going to vote. Well, that's a wash. That doesn't help candidate A or candidate B. But by saying I am going to withhold, or we as a company are going to withhold contributions from only those that refuse, for instance, to recognize the validity of the election, that's much more of a candidate for profiles and courage than those companies that just said, we're going to back out altogether. So I guess kudos, in terms, if the scale, the measuring stick here is courage and desire to have an impact, those companies, Lilly and others, that took a stand here probably deserve the blue ribbon.
Nikki Kelly, leaving aside the skepticism of some, including me, that these companies will really withhold these contributions into the future, like it might be one of those, well, we won't do it for 9 months, but come 2022, let's open the spigot. But leaving aside that, if they really do withhold these contributions or stop giving, will it make much of a difference to folks like Jim Banks and Jackie Walorski, Greg Pence and Jim Baird?
I mean, one or two companies, no. But if more companies do it, you know, I looked up Congressman Banks, for example. He got $10,000 from Eli Lilly. I did see, for instance, that Comcast is also doing the same thing. Congressman Banks got $8,000 for him. So it all depends, you know, how many companies do this, whether it starts to add up.
All right. Well, let's move on. A bill that would give Hoosier workers the right to refuse employer-mandated vaccines had its first hearing in a committee this week. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports the bill would go further than current federal laws and excuse workers based on their conscience.
Currently, federal law allows employers to have mandatory vaccine policies, but workers can opt out if they have a medical disability or sincerely held religious belief. Senator Dennis Cruz, author of the bill, said it goes a step further and exempts employees from vaccination based on personal choice.
The word conscience is the essence of the bill.
Okay.
I mean, that's the additional part that is not an existing law.
Many testified in support of the bill, arguing that it would protect their personal liberties and civil rights. However, business groups and a researcher testified against it, saying it would infringe on workplace safety laws and could create easily preventable disease outbreaks in the future. The committee did not take a vote on the bill or proposed amendments that would remove the word conscience.
Nikki Kelly, the timing of this bill works both ways. It's obviously about COVID-19, which could work both for it and against it, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think actually if they narrowed the bill to just COVID-19, a lot of lawmakers would be on board with it. Because, you know, it's true, we don't have decades of research on this vaccine like we do for measles and mumps and polio, smallpox. So that might help it. Another thing that might help is if they allow healthcare industry. That was a lot of the testimony was, you know, hospitals, they require their doctors and nurses, these people who are interacting, to have all these vaccines because they could then spread it to people when they're in their care. So that's a big deal. And honestly, if you take conscience out, there's no reason for the bill because, you know, law already covers medical and other reasons, your religious reasons.
John Schwanis, how does the General, if the General Assembly passes this bill, largely unchanged, which seems unlikely, but for the sake of argument, how are people going to feel about that?
It cuts two ways. As so many is the case with so many bills, a statement of the obvious, I suppose. For those who showed up in fairly significant numbers at the State House this week to support this bill, you know, this is American values at their best. This is a notion that we control our own destinies and certainly what is introduced into our bodies. But for the rest of the people who may be the patients are receiving care from those individuals, as Nikki suggested, or, you know, customers who whose food or products are being handled or exposed to the individuals who may have said, gee, I have a conscientious objection to doing what medical science says is right, those folks aren't going to like it. So I don't know how it plays. If this were limited to COVID, it would be an easier call. In the end, again, I mean, this goes back to 100 plus years in the U.S. Supreme Court with the notion, could you be forced to get a smallpox vaccine? Not just in the case of employers, but just in the case of society as a whole, American society. Generally speaking, I think modern science and modern society will dictate in the long run that people do get vaccines. For the most part.
We're going to talk probably more about this issue as we see it move forward in the legislative process and see what, if any, changes happen. But I want to stay on the topic of this committee hearing this week because it was disrupted when dozens of people who showed up to testify refused to wear masks, which are required in the State House. The presence of so many defiantly unmasked people led others to leave out of concerns for their safety. And Senate President Pro Tem Roderick Bray says legislative leaders are working with Capitol Police to fix the issue.
We intend to make it a safe place where people can feel comfortable to come.
Speaker Todd Houston says legislative leaders working with state government officials haven't decided how to enforce the mask-wearing requirement.
Every day I'm dealing with an issue that we hadn't thought of or didn't think of or it's just arisen. And so our teams will work through those issues.
Republican legislative leaders decided at the start of session not to require lawmakers to wear masks. Mike O'Brien, if the idea of enforcement of the mask-wearing requirement that exists at the State House and the State Government Center isn't resolved quickly, how much of a problem will this be to making the session work the way it should?
Well, it's not going to be much of a problem if people insist on trying to make a point and they close the building. Ironically, probably under the authority of the governor's emergency declaration order. So, look, I mean, legislative leaders are focused on making sure this is a safe process. And if people are going to deliberately undermine that because they want to have some proxy political fight about wearing a mask and it being an infringement on your personal liberty, then they're just going to not be allowed to come into the building, I don't think.
Yeah. And Delaney, was it important that both Republican leaders said, we acknowledge this, we are working with the Capitol Police, we will get this fixed relatively quickly?
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, they can take the same position that so many different places that retail stores are taking. You can't come in without a mask, period. And if you take the mask off, you're asked to leave. And it isn't only about their personal rights, okay? It's about the rest of us that don't want to be infected if they happen to be carrying. And they don't want to acknowledge the fact that they could be giving this virus to other people. Yeah. Either that or they don't care. But the rest of us do, and they should be barred if they're not wearing masks.
All right. Well, that is Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please wear a mask, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.